Hello, good evening, and welcome to the TNT show. Hello, I'm John Drummond, and I'm your host for the next 60 exciting minutes. Thank you for joining us this evening. We have yet another great guest tonight, and I'm really excited that he's able to join us. Stay tuned to hear from someone who is not only an accomplished businessman, but also has his thumb on the economic pulse of Scotland. Now to our guest tonight. The Nation talks to Andrew Wilson. How are you, Andrew? How are you coping with the pandemic?
Thank you, John. Yes, everything's okay. It's been a long haul. I'm in my little office room in my garden, which I'm lucky to have. And basically, I've been looking after three children for most of lockdown, but they've behaved impeccably. So business has gone on, life has gone on. It's been a shocker for in many regards, hasn't it? But, you know, we just have to get on with it. And so we've tried to do that. So I've got no complaints. Yeah, everything's okay.
Any special challenges? I mean, running a family and a successful business at the same time?
I'm in a fortunate position as a single parent, as it were, where I've got to the stage of life. The kids are, what, 10, I better get this right, 10, 14 and 15. You know, one's got, you know, extra challenges for himself, but no, they're a joy. And in the way I've got very supportive colleagues across the business. And all the other little things that I'm involved in, charities and obviously Motherwell, the football club's a big deal for me. And I've gone back on the board there. That's Scotland's first fan-owned club. So it's living the independence message. But I grew up in Wishaw, John, as you'll know, and went to school there. Great, had a great time, loved it. And then we're off to uni. And that's, you know, how I got going. But I joined, you know, the SNP and got interested when I was at school. Actually, I joined CND first, funnily enough. It was at a time when everyone was really frightened about the threat of nuclear weapons in the early 80s, and it politicised a lot of people. And so I joined that first, but then got involved in SNP, and I got involved in Motherwell South, as the constituency was then, and made the mistake of agreeing to be the election agent for the 92 election for Kay Ulrich, who was a wonderful person, made famous by the Monklands by-election, which she went on to run in against Helen Liddell, narrow defeat. But she was a great woman, learnt a lot from her. And, you know, we had a great time in that election. We thought we were winning at one point. There was a poll before it that 50% of people agreed with independence. The Sun came out for independence. We thought we were winning. In the end, I think we got about 20%. Good lesson in life. But it just shows you how far we've come as a party and as the movement, you know, from there to where we are now. We've got, you know, a wonderful MP and a wonderful MSP for that seat. And it's nothing. Yeah. And of course, North Lanarkshire voted for yes. They were not cowed in 2014, and that made me emotional at the time.
Yeah. Well, I think we all were in many respects. It was one of those nights that I think will stay in our memories, our collective memories, forever.
Now,
you were talking about education there, Andrew. Now, you had a good education. How does that compare with the education that you feel that your children and their peers are getting now?
Well, I went to the local company. I went to the third best school in Wishaw. But it was a great high school. The teachers were knocking their pans in for us. All the after school stuff. At that point, we couldn't have after school football so much. If you remember, there was a strike, and so it wasn't, you know, that stuff didn't happen. But we had a school band, a school orchestra, and we travelled Europe with that. It was amazing. I had the most boring job, which was the timpani player, which made me good for economics, because as a timpanist, you sit at the back of the orchestra and you count through the bars. 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 2, 3, 4, bong. Then you start again. So it really tees you up to being a desiccated economics upbringing. But I went the big dominant part of my life at that time, obviously loving family, looking after me, and the Boys Brigade. I was busy like five nights a week. We'd be out doing various things with the Boys Brigade at the time, which meant, you know, you were too busy to get into trouble. And there's a lot in that. And the school orchestra was great fun. So these were, I think, when I think back, these were the things that dominated my life, you know, outward bounds with the Duke of Edinburgh stuff that we all used to do. So it was a great, at that point, Ravenscraig was still open through most of, in fact, through all of my youth, Ravenscraig was still open. So Wishaw and Motherwell were bustling, doing relatively well, working class towns. And of course, Ravenscraig closes in 92. We're told that the Labour MP said that we would sell it to the Americans, and it shut. And you know, it didn't have to shut.
Yeah.
It shut because we were part of British Steel, and it made sense for them to centralise in South Wales. But you know, if you were, again, it's another good example of a thing that sort of politicised me, the sense that we could do better, because that was a great and efficient plant, and wish we had a capacity for it now. But anyway, these are all the little things that happen. And then I go off to St Andrews University, end up going to Strathclyde as well, and get a good, you know, get a good education. And but I was always politically active throughout all of that.
Yeah. And your kids now, how do you feel about them?
Well, sorry, you were saying, yeah, no, they do really well. They're a mixture of different things because of Harry's challenges. He goes to a school that's really suited to him. His wee brother goes to the local high school, and his wee sister's with him. So no, they do well. I'm really lucky in as much as, you know, autism is a thing where, you know, the lockdown could have been grim. You know, for many people with autism, it must have been pretty horrific. But I was lucky because Harry basically was a lesson to the rest of us. He was up at 7 every morning, walked the dog, made his bed, had his breakfast, started his homework, totally devoted to good order. And I'm lucky with that. So no, it's fine. I've got little, I mean, I never complain, as at least I complain a lot to the people I love and my nearest and dearest, but I never complain generally as best I can anyway.
Yeah. They're quite close in age, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
How do they all get on together?
Variably, I would say. Hannah, the daughter, is a highly sophisticated young woman who's going to be a great thinker, I think. And she's just a big loving soul. Harry's Harry, and Hamish is the middle child that is, you know, I depend upon him. He puts up with a lot, takes on a lot, and no, they all got on fine. Of course, they fight like brothers everywhere fight, I suppose, don't they? And these two, they dispute one another's correctness all of the time, but it's nothing bad.
It would be very odd, I think, if it were otherwise.
Yeah.
It'd be a source of real concern if it were otherwise. Yeah.
Before this, I was having a meeting just before this in the centre of town with a pretty well known business person who's a big funder of the No campaign and the cause there, and we were sort of debating it out. I've not persuaded him yet. But everyone's a potential convert. But he was just saying he comes from a big family in Greenock where I think he's got 5 siblings, so most of them voted yes and will vote yes.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show families can disagree as long as they can do so in a spirit of mutual respect. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. You think he would come on the show?
I don't know. I'll ask him.
Yeah, I'll ask him. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, we had somebody from George Galloway's party on the show recently.
He has a party now. I must have missed that meeting. He's got his own party.
He has his own party.
Wow.
And that was very, very enlightening.
Oh, of course, he has the Alliance for Unity. Yeah, yes, I did.
Alliance for Unity. Yeah, absolutely.
And a unifying bunch, from what I can gather.
Yeah, well, she's a candidate, and she's very dedicated, and looking forward to standing for a list position next year for the Scottish Parliament. But I was very happy to have her on because I think we have to think outside the silos and talk across whatever divides that there may be, so we can reach out for some common ground. So I'd love to have more and more people on from people who don't necessarily feel very committed or at all, like even if completely opposed to independence. I think the
tone's really important, John, because obviously there's a bunch of folk who are like us implacably for. There's a bunch for whom it will be very difficult ever to reach. And then there's everyone else in the middle who are open to persuasion, but will be persuaded by reason and calm argument and persuasion. Yeah. And if we're not careful by being so energetic in our opposition to our opponents, we can turn people away. And obviously, and the other point to make is that when we're successful, which I believe we will be, we've got to unify the country behind making it good.
Exactly.
Because I don't believe that, you know, in the day after independence, the world just gets automatically better. It's not, there's not a pot of gold there, but there is a toolbox at the end of the rainbow. Yeah. And we can use that to build a better country, and it will take time. I think my core message to people is that independence will be hard work. It will be an effort. There will be a transition that will not be simple because we'll be unpicking 300 years of integration. But that effort will be worth it, very much worth it. But it will take time. And I think people are more likely to be convinced by that argument than by the sense that, you know, we've either got oil so everything's for free and it all lands in our lap, or that there's some other wizard wheeze that no other country's thought about. That automatically delivers a better world. If something doesn't sound right, it sounds too good to be true, then there's probably a reason for that.
Yeah.
And I think the big thing to do is to look around the world to the countries that we would like to be like. We don't want to copy everything about anyone else because we want to make our own way. But you know, if countries like New Zealand, which is actually a touch less well off than Scotland, but much better run, great example, pro-migration, pro-international engagement, very welcoming to people, big tourism industry, at least until COVID struck. Yeah. Now with their current Prime Minister looking very, like a real progressive force in the world, a great example. When we used New Zealand with the Growth Commission, it was immediately attacked, like anything in Scotland is attacked as if we were, you know, they're right wing, therefore we're right wing. It's people want to label other people and attack the badge rather than considering actually, you know, there are sophisticated models to be considered. The other big one is Denmark. People say Scotland couldn't have a furlough. Denmark announced its furlough scheme before Britain. It's a highly functioning society. You know, what does Denmark have that Scotland doesn't have? And yet it's many times more wealthy than Scotland is. And another example we looked at was Finland, which again, sophisticated, great education system, you know, big neighbour next to it, and it's had its calamities over the years. It's gone bust a few times, or almost, a big banking crisis in the 90s. It's had many problems, but it's bounced back. It's, you know, was unhealthy, now is very healthy. So there are great examples around the world to look to say, well, what, if they can do it, why can't we? Yeah. Why would we not want to be like a society like that? That's what makes it worth it. Mm-hmm. The alternative is to be part of a United Kingdom, which has been in relative decline for, well, for certainly all of our lives, John, and probably longer. Yeah. And people talk about currency as a symbol of it, and I'm sure we can come on to have a natter about that. But the pound was worth about $5 in the 30s. It's now worth barely a dollar. Yeah. You know, that's a sort of map of relative decline. Yeah. You know, the currencies bounce around, but broadly speaking, they can reflect what the world thinks of your economic prospectus and outlook. Yeah. And that's true. And right now, the OECD judges that Britain has got the prospects to be the worst performing economy in the OECD and the industrialized world of 37 countries this year.
Yeah, it's good.
And if that's the status quo, that looks high risk to me.
Yeah.
And all these years in, John, after the Brexit vote, which is, of course, why we're back talking about independence, is because that's changed the game. All of these years on, 4+ years on from Brexit, we still don't know the nature of the border that's being opposed against our will to our west and to our east, two borders with Brexit. And we don't know the nature of it. And there's a reason, you know, we're seeing prime ministers of the past coming out to attack it. Richard Keane, who I don't regard as that political a player, you know, a high quality advocate at the Scottish bar, but, you know, was chairman of the Conservative Party in Scotland for a bit. Mm. He's resigned. You know, Geoffrey Cox couldn't vote for the bill, at least I think that I followed that correctly. People of integrity are really worried about the state of Britain. And again, what does that point to? The need to respect the rule of law, to be a good counterparty in international relations. And if we're going to say to the European Union, we'd like to be a member again, you go in that with full open faith that you will seek to fulfil the obligations that go with it. And I think Britain's setting a really bad standard for itself.
That takes us on to, I mean, that's a very good point. It takes us on to some of the questions that have been raised about independence. We can perhaps come to the Growth Commission and currency later, Andrew. Mm. But there's a growing sense of unease. And I think it stems from people's very deep concerns about negotiating with a government or an administration which is happy to break the law. And what people are saying is, how can this possibly work? How can you possibly negotiate with somebody who is footloose and fancy-free when it comes to morals, ethics, and obeying the law? I mean, what confidence would you have in any negotiation with somebody who takes that view of politics?
No, it is a dilemma, isn't it? Because, of course, it points to the fact that Boris Johnson as Prime Minister can continue to say no, even if there's a very substantial mandate from the next Scottish election and subsequent Parliament. What do we do? Now, part of this dilemma we need to remember is a big part of why we're back again is because Scotland, now a majority, wants to be independent and back in the European Union. Part of getting back into the European Union involves the approval of their member states. Now, one of the things that troubles some people is the sense that particularly Spain might veto. And of course, they could do that. What I understand of the Spanish government's position at the moment is that if Scotland pursues a constitutional route to independence, they would have no objection. Now, this is important because we want the legitimacy of the international community. And in 2014, of course, all the European Union states were defending their own co-member in the UK. And David Cameron, as you know, spent a lot of time going around the capitals trying to get other political leaders to argue. Even Vladimir Putin was approached by David Cameron to say, could you oppose Scottish independence? So it's important that we stay in the right side of legitimacy, that we win and continue to win friends in the international community that will be accepting of it. And I think as the support for yes continues to tick up And there's the polls that say people want it, but not yet. I mean, the polling still says that people would like to have a vote, but in a number of years' time, as that all closes in, the pressure on the UK government will continue to increase. So there's that point. The other point, when we get to the negotiation itself, which is missed by most people, for those that have read what we've said in the articulation of the report we did now back a year past in May, one of the things that people miss is they assume that we would be in a weak position in that negotiation because we're the smaller partner and we're doing leaving. But the what we set out was the suggestion that we adopt the opposite of the sort of two fingers to Europe that the UK has done. Because one of the things that people, I suppose, don't really know is if you look at the balance sheet of the United Kingdom, they actually publish whole of government accounts and they assess all of the liabilities and all of the assets of the UK. Now, we might disagree with some of the valuations and that will be part of the negotiation. But before COVID struck, broadly speaking, the UK had 2.5 trillion of assets and 4 trillion of liabilities. So the liability obviously is their debt or the debt that's shared by the UK. The pensions, which are underfunded if you're public sector workers, or unfunded altogether, and for old age, state pension, which when you think about it, is just daft. I mean, why, with a demographic time bomb looming, we don't fund pensions in the way that anyone else would fund their pension by saving for it. We pay it out of current tax. And that's a big problem for a lot of countries, but particularly for the UK. And then there's daft things in there which you wouldn't believe. For example, there's a $350 billion liability for the decommissioning of Sellafield. Just one thing. You can imagine if we'd thought about that and said, well, actually, we're taking on nuclear power, but there's a cost we're handing on to the next generation of that order. Would you have taken the same decision in the same way? So, of course, as we go into that negotiation, the UK is not, we're not asking the UK to give us, please, a share of the assets. They're asking us to please take a share of the liabilities. Yeah. And then we'll see what we set out is we would say, well, actually, there's probably a negotiation here, which means that if we're paying a contribution towards debt interest, which I believe we should, that it will be smaller than currently slated in the GERS analysis. Mm-hmm. We've also set out in there, John, that we would do, in the period before we can have our own international aid programs, because day one, we might not have put a proper program together that we could continue to fund the UK's effort until we were ready to fund our own. So we're actually going into that negotiation with a message to the people of the rest of the United Kingdom that we accept responsibility, we recognise our ongoing shared commitments, there'll be many things we want to do together, we will have the closest relationship of any two countries in the world, we hope, but we want to go our own way. It's not a question of a rejection of the people of the rest of the United Kingdom, it's the adoption of a sense of responsibility for ourselves. And we have a conversation in that way in London or anywhere else across the UK, people get it. That point has not, I don't think, resonated from the report. Much of the debate was around deficit and currency. Yeah. As people come to see, we've actually thought through the negotiation. The power is not one way. We have, a strong arguments on our side. And then we're into other arguments. The border remains unclear. We didn't look at it, obviously, because we didn't know what the situation with Europe was going to be, and we're still to find out. But if you look at we buy more from the United Kingdom than we sell to it. So again, yeah. There's an interest there in good order and in a good relationship. The lesson of history is that beggar thy neighbour policies fail for everyone. There was a wonderful piece in the Financial Times a few weeks ago by Raghuram Rajan, who was the central bank governor of India. He was the chief economist at the IMF. He was meant to be the governor of the Bank of England after Mark Carney, but decided Britain's politics were not for him. And he was arguing as obviously...
Not sure I blame him.
Hi. He was arguing that the industrialised, successful world had to look after the interests of the developing world with COVID, not just because it was morally the right thing to do, but that we have a self-interest in it because the lift all boats argument is obvious. But the disorder that comes from grinding poverty, is the price is paid for it in the West. And we know this.
Yeah.
So there's an argument, and we're living in a world where globalization's retreating, barriers are going up, and small countries need to combine with each other, need to make the argument for continued cooperation, for being good citizens. And we see, for example, in the Wellbeing Alliance, which is really interesting between New Zealand, Iceland, and the Scottish government, there's an example of geography doesn't matter. This is about combination on the basis of values, which is really interesting. It gives us a sense of purpose for not only how do we transition to be independent, not only can we be a member of the EU, you know, in our own modest way as a small country, we can play a part in driving arguments that are really important. I mean,
Can I pick you up on the point of values? Because I think it's, from my personal point of view, it's very important.
Of course.
But one of the things I've never understood, for all its merits or demerits, and the Growth Commission, we can come to that in a second perhaps, why we didn't start off with a written constitution which said to the whole world and to ourselves, this is the sort of country that we will create. And then the Growth Commission is based on those values which we have all agreed. We seem to have sort of rather rushed our fences. And there was nobody quite knows, as we sit here right now, what an independent Scotland would stand for and what it would not stand for. You've made a very good case for a clear set of values, of a community spirit. These are all very laudable, but there's nothing in writing. And no, if you look at other independence movements, the first thing they do is to say, this is what you're signing up for in its totality. And then we can talk about the other aspects of it thereafter. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I have to say, John, I've listened to you make that argument for quite some time. You know, we first got to know each other, funnily enough, wasn't it, in the sort of 2003 election period when you were helping me with polling in Cumbernauld and Kilsyth, where I was running to try and beat the Labour MSP, and I was always grateful for that. And you always brought a sort of international rationalism, which I found very admirable. The argument around the Constitution, I think you're correct. I was given a very specific brief by the First Minister on the Growth Commission, which didn't involve doing everything else, and we had to obviously stick to the brief. But interesting, it might reassure you a bit to know that obviously there was as well as having a team of economists, we had international consultants that helped us with commissioned work. Patrick Dunleavy at the LSE working on the setup costs, David Skilling, who is a New Zealand national, then in Singapore, now living in Amsterdam, who's a small country specialist, who looked at the public finances, governance, and the growth record of the countries we'd like to be like. So we had great help. Around that table were obviously great academics, serving politicians, including, of course, our now Cabinet Secretary for Finance, Kate Forbes. And the first thing we did was sit and talk about the values that would underpin it. I'm not saying that we defined the way that you've said, which probably is work that should be done. But we were talking, you know, what was the country we were seeking to be like? It was open,
I understand
welcoming.
That, Andrew. Yeah. I just wondered if anyone ever said, you know something, we ought to set this down before we go any further. Because without knowing that, how do we know how to commission the Growth Commission if we don't understand and agree the values that we share? I hear what you're saying. You made some assumptions about the values, and that's perfectly reasonable. But a different way of doing it would have been to say, let's go out and find out what these values are, and then we'll do that.
Well, you'll get no argument from me against that, John. Okay. But the task we were given was pretty substantial in and of itself. It was, you know...
Well, it was a huge piece of work, no question.
Go off and resolve for the currency question, which was difficult in 14. Go off and resolve for public finances and what we do about them. Go off and resolve for the sort of growth model we would need to make this country successful and be honest about it. So that was the brief which we worked on.
Okay. Well, maybe we can come back together and talk about that. Several people have asked, and it's a reasonable point, Andrew, with the internal market legislation, this is moving ahead. It's moving ahead. It's quite clear that the government is committed to it. It makes the most extraordinary changes to devolution. Effectively, maybe not quite as dramatically as I put it in the Sunday National, in rolling back 20-odd years of devolution. But it does go a long way to rolling it back, where government ministers can decide in Westminster decisions over health, education, etc., all of which are presently devolved. So the question arises, if one takes a measured approach towards independence, how does that fit with a UK which is utterly changed, i.e. grossly centralised? How do you unpick something which is even more centralised than the version that you were aware of when the Growth Commission did its work?
Well, I don't think it influences what we would argue for, the transition we would seek to undertake. I mean, I think the conduct of the UK government being terrible doesn't mean that we should emulate it. I think we should do the opposite. We should demonstrate to the international community, to the European Union, that in us they have an orderly, sophisticated democracy with a plan for the transition that will work, that they can do business with. and that all of our citizens can understand that we've thought it through. Here we are 4 years on, there was no plan for Brexit. There still isn't a plan, apparently, for Brexit 4 years in, and we have this unraveling and disorder. And the price for that is being paid already. The economy, jobs, under pressure on a massive scale, even without COVID. Britain was going into recession before COVID struck. The cost to the public finances, enormous. But if you listen to our opponents on the unionist side, Brexit produces a massive increase in the national debt. That somehow is demonstrating that the UK is helping Scotland because of a great dividend for the union. Of course, it's a nonsense. You know, we would have voted against that and we wouldn't have had it. So I don't think the wrongheadedness or the disorder of the UK is a reason to emulate, nor do I see it altering the prospectus that I would think will win and I think we're about to put, should we have a referendum.
Why do you think it will win?
I think it will win because growing numbers of people already think that Scotland should do this. I think it will win because it's what we're going to say is honest. It's a prospectus which demonstrates how it can be done. I believe very much in the quality of the people of Scotland and their ability to run themselves better, because that is the essence of it. It's not like the Irish joke, you know, how do I get to the village? I wouldn't start from here. That is the core of the unionist argument.
Yeah.
Because the UK is so badly run, so unequal, because the deficits of the regions and nations are so high, because the balance of payments and trade is so poor, second worst by scale in the world, it's so bad you can't change it. This is as good as it gets. Whereas what you can see is, and I think it will be actually much quicker, even than the quite moderate outlook that we put into the Commission projections, which were deliberately modest in their assumptions, I think we will move quite quickly to quite a dynamic economic outlook for Scotland. The very act of becoming independent will create a dynamism for our economy, which will be positive. People talk about, for example, John, the costs of setup. But the work from the London School of Economics shows that actually, no matter what you spend on the setup, it might be what we say, it might be more, it might be three times that amount. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. Because the dynamic of setting up your own system of government, creating the institutions that are currently, we currently pay to have housed in London, the most expensive real estate, the most expensive labour market in Europe, would be in Scotland, Edinburgh, elsewhere in Scotland. And so the knock-on benefits of those wages and salaries coming into our country would be felt. And Professor Dunleavy thought it would take 6 years for that investment to pay back. So there's one big argument that the unionists put, which is it would cost a lot. Well, it might cost, but it would be really cheap to fund that cost because, as you can see from the world debt markets just now, money is very cheap. Yep. But that money would pay back. And we're investing in a new future, a completely different economy than the one that we've got at the moment. And that's something very much to look forward to.
I think people's concern is slightly different. I think people are confident that the work the Scottish Government has done is good and it's terribly important and it will stand the country in good stead. I think the concern is a slightly broader one, which is that people are deeply anxious about a process of centralisation which will now kick in, whereby effectively the Scottish Parliament will be emasculated because financial decisions will be taken, spending decisions will be taken elsewhere. There will be no consultation. The bill doesn't call for any consultation. It simply suggests that a government minister is in a position to make the decision. So what that means, essentially, is that the role for the Scottish Parliament is necessarily reduced. And we are in a very different environment. You know, I'm just wondering how much more difficult it will be to present arguments when, I mean, for example, people are very concerned in the light of the BBC's recent decision about the First Minister's COVID updates to decide to discontinue those or in any shape or form. People found that decision in all parts apart from the Conservative Party perplexing. And many people have said, well, this is the way things are going to be in future. A lot of the small decisions that we perhaps take in Scotland will now be taken elsewhere without regard to the feelings of the people here. Now, that may well stoke up extra support for independence, but it might make the negotiation process very lengthy. It might be 10 years away from here and then be very complicated because by that time, a whole process of centralization will have become established. What's your thinking about that?
Well, I noticed Professor David Bell had made this point to one of the parliamentary committees today around the financial implications. Many people are dismissing this argument, saying, "Oh, we're just repatriating powers from Europe." And of course, no. I think judge the intent. You know, look, what is the intent here? The intent here is to try and stymie the Scottish case. That is the motivation, and I don't think it's an orderly one. I don't think it's a good one. It's not good governance. This will drive support up for independence. Remember, David Bell, who was criticising it, was until recently on the board of These Islands, the pro-union thing. He's not now, which is interesting. Also a Motherwell supporter, so to be trusted, David, I think, on all matters. I think it will drive support in our direction. Not only that, it provides a strategic challenge to the Labour and Conservative parties in Scotland to say, on whose side are you? Do you stand behind devolution and home rule, or don't you? Civic Scotland, likewise. And I think that's part of the growing reason why this is going to happen, John, because more and more people who were doubtful of the case for independence in 2014 are increasingly of that view, and that's showing in the polls. But even behind the polls, obviously, two-thirds of people under the age of 55 now in favour, three-quarters under the age of 35 now in favour, roughly 63% of those who express a preference think it's going to happen. So there's a growing sense of the will of the Scottish people settling, against which we have increased this. I mean, you only have to look, which if you do, you should do so in little doses. But if you look at Twitter, you can see increasingly, what's the word for it? It's the sort of, well, disorder is the polite way of putting it, the shrill extremism of some of the campaigning individuals and groups who are not reflecting their best selves in how they're conducting themselves. And we need to be careful of this too, because I do think Scotland's history is full of Scotland fighting with itself, people on the same side finding their version of events so much more important than everyone else's that we'd rather hold out for purity than get a consensus that allows us to progress. There's a joke I often used to tell about this, John, and it's probably apocryphal, from one of the many Celtic European victories. And let's just say it was the Seville Cup final, where two guys are outside after the match, thumbing a lift back to Scotland, and a guy stops the car and says, "Well, I'm actually driving back. Where are you going?" And he said to them, "Well, I'm driving to Edinburgh." And they said, "No, it's fine. We're going to Glasgow." So, I often think, I've thought that about those who oppose devolution. There were some in the SNP who argued that devolution was a bad idea and we should oppose it, that it would be a one-way street that would lock us in. Of course, history has confounded that. We need to take, you know, every step that we can to keep the consensus for progress. And I now think that those arguing for home rule, for example, or fiscal autonomy, which in the immediate aftermath of devolution, when independence seemed some way off, I would be arguing for that. But now the world has fundamentally changed. The only solution to get us back into the European Union and the world community, to have values that we want to live by, is independence. And I think that argument is increasingly compelling, John.
I think that's why I think we missed a trick by not talking about a written constitution, because then we would have talked to the whole world about our values. But that's just my ad for today. I also feel that it seems to me it's awfully important to have that conversation with as many people as possible, and it's also important to set the Scottish independence movement in historical context. If you look at independence movements across the world, I think that's where a whole chunk of useful education is missing. We seem to think that the trials and tribulations that we've just discussed are unique to us. They're not. They're not. You've only got to look at the history of the United States when it became independent. Folks were quarreling all the time, you know, and people were writing the most ridiculous things about each other in the public prints. They didn't have Twitter, of course, but some of the stuff was just as vehement, I have to say. I mean, anyone who's read any of the stuff about during the American Revolution is frankly, I mean, it's gobsmacking how vitriolic people were about colleagues, for crying out loud. People who were actually fighting together were actually fighting each other at the same time. So this is not unusual. I mean, this is part and parcel. What it means, though, is that people need to perhaps have a great understanding of how that fits in that context. And I think we're missing a bit of that, which is why we feel, oh, this is peculiar to us. It just ain't. You know, every independence movement has this. We can look at India as well. Here's a question that came in from Robin McAlpin. He says, you know, in terms of the proposed monetary system, there are only four countries in the world that actually use it, i.e. the one you're proposing in the Growth Commission, Panama, Ecuador, Montenegro, and Liechtenstein. Why should Scotland become the fifth? No advanced economy like Scotland has ever used a money system like this in modern history. Why should Scotland become the first?
Well, Robin, who is a very intelligent contributor to the debate, misses the big one, which is obviously Ireland. Ireland did exactly this when it became independent. For about 6 years, it retained sterling. And then for decades, it kept a peg with sterling. And of course, that was in a different era before we had FX markets to the extent that they are now, before we had the level of monetary integration and sophistication that we have today. Yeah. So what we're proposing is that we get to have our own currency, but in a manner which is orderly, when we're prepared for it and when it's in our interest. The six tests that we have, by the way, those tests can be altered, they can be tweaked, they can be reduced. COVID puts a challenge on a couple, in my view, we can come back to that, but not the order of it. Because what we would, the risks that we're managing for are both political and economic. The economic risk is if you say to the world that we'll become independent in the day after or the next weeks or months, we'll have our own currency. The question is immediately posed, well, what will happen to that currency? Will it go down? Will it go up? And with the level of integration we've got, that is a direct implication, not just for the price of goods in our shops, for our wages, for our mortgage payments, for our pension payments. And these are all reasons of concern for people. Our unionist opponents would love us to be arguing for this. And that's the reason that Alex Salmond stuck to currency union as his argument in 2014. So that there was that point. And the second point of economics is the risk of people thinking it was a concern and so moving their money out, whether they're people or companies, what's called capital flight. This happened in Quebec on a grand scale, and they never even became independent, and they paid a price in jobs and for the economy. So we've articulated effectively, and it's not what Robin said, because these are countries that have then adopted other countries' currencies. We are saying all that we have just now stays the same the day after independence. So if you're voting for independence, you know that what you've got just now stays the same. There's a logic to this, because if the UK is 100 in its performance, Scotland's about 100. We're the most average of the UK regions and nations economic performance-wise. So monetary policy works reasonably well for us. There's not a reason to diverge yet. But we hope that the reason for setting up our currency will be A, that we're prepared, and I'll come back to that, but B, it will be a sign of our success because we'll have diverged. We'll be growing so fast, we'll have diversified our exports such that it would be in our interest. The political reason is, of course, do you want to spend a referendum campaign talking about the implications of your currency policy like this, answering questions that are reasonable? What would happen to my pension? Would it go up? Would it go down? What would happen to my mortgage? And what this policy does politically is allow us to say that we will stay as we are just now. That's a policy endorsed by the former governor of the central bank, Mervyn King. The logical thing to do, he thinks. Of course, we're ceding sovereignty to the Bank of England on monetary policy to begin with. But that's no change from where we are now. But we'll move towards it as we begin to set up our central bank. We begin to fund our deficit like all countries do. And I think COVID has changed that, because what it shows is that the world debt markets are funding all countries very cheaply at the moment. Croatia got a bond away at 0.9% only the other week there. So I think what I would change about the Growth Commission at the moment would be less of a focus, because we were going in looking like an outlier on deficit. And I think there's less of a worry about that now, because all of the countries of Europe, with a few exceptions, will be in that boat. Yeah. And we'll have a different position on debt. But the currency policy we've set out is economically stable, and it graduates away from it. It could happen, you know, if we're successful, and I think we will be, we would look to be setting up our own currency to reflect that. But the alternative is both economically concerning and would politically be, I think, not a winning argument. Not least, you look at the polls, percentage of people in Scotland who support that idea, 5%. So you'd be going into a referendum with a main plank of your economic argument supported by 1 in 20 people. Yeah. So there are economic reasons, which are the core reasons for it, but there are also political reasons for it. Mm-hmm. The currency should reflect our progress and success. You know, you're not going to drive it by monetary policy. I do know that there are some who argue that actually we should just print money, forget about the deficit, and that's the way to go. Modern monetary theory, it's called. I've read about it in some detail. It's a theory that no one has tried yet. There are some countries in history who have effectively done an equivalent, and it's not a happy thing, because it's led to hyperinflation.
Sorry, can I stop you there? Because we've had a number of questions about modern monetary theory. By the way, I apologize to everyone in the audience. You're saying, good gracious, where are we going now? But bear with us, because it is pertinent. Alan Jones has asked, my question for Andrew is, Stephanie Kelton has recently written a best-selling book, The Deficit Myth. You've just said you're aware of the book. His contention, along with others, is that deficits are a chimera. They're a myth, literally. And she points out in her book that deficits have never prevented any country, for example, from going to war. In any way impede Greenspan and other executives from bailing out the banks, where they found billions of dollars overnight. They just printed it, and they called it quantitative easing, and the world didn't fall apart. And her contention is, frankly, it's been tried. It's been tried since FDR did it way back in the big deal, and right through. So she's questioning your assertion that it's never been done. She says it has been done. It happens in wartime. It happens in other events too. And it works, she says, because the actual deficit is actually a myth. It's just a way of expressing government spending. That's all. Yeah. The government spends it or individuals do, one of the two.
Yeah, so and I do understand the argument. Effectively, what they argue is that you print money, and if the consequences, the risk of inflation, if that kicks in, you then tax the consequences away. So fiscal policy is the means of monetary stability, not monetary policy. Now, this is a debate which for many people will seem arcane. If it were true, and she's right, it's a theory that's not yet in practice, why doesn't Denmark, New Zealand, Sweden, the countries we would like to emulate, why don't they do it? Why do we have tax at all if we can just print it?
Well, she says that the reason that governments tax is to alter behavior. It's not because they need the money. They already have the money because they can print it with all that monetary sovereignty. Of course, one would sacrifice that if one stayed with sterlingization. I think that's the very broad point. And I think what people are suggesting is that not that things ought to be recast, but rather to say, is this not something that's worth looking at in a bit more detail?
Well, let's see if the argument runs anywhere. I think the wrong place to be doing the theory or to try a new theory out in practice would be in a new country just emerging into the world. The risks of it are gargantuan. Now, there may be something in it for America. I know that's where Stephanie and the hedge funds that support her are based. It may even work for a country like China. But there would be a reason why countries like Denmark and others not just fund their public services, but in the case of Denmark, help manage their own currencies pegged to the euro by borrowing cheaply on international markets. I think it's back to what I said at the top of this discussion, John. If something sounds too good to be true, logic dictates that it probably is. Now, we can see the countries that have gone fast and loose with printing. Venezuela at the moment is a great example. There are others in history that are well known. This may indeed work. I wouldn't want to risk my own children's future on experimenting with them. The big thing about debt is, of course, it can hand on to future generations a significant burden. If it's invested wisely, and I personally right now, I'm a very big supporter of accessing debt markets on a big scale to invest in creating a greener and different future. Mm. I think if we really, because we used to say in politics, John, you and I know this well, we used to say to people in Scotland that independence will be easy because of oil. We don't really need to work that much harder because of oil. Everything's free, everything's fine. Now, there actually was an argument for that up to a point, but people didn't believe it because it sounded too good to be true. To replace that by saying, do you know what? We don't actually have to work any harder. Everything's free because we just print cash and the government then taxes the consequences. Do people buy that? I don't think so. I know that there are very enthusiastic adherents to this, some of whom are in the SNP even. I think it would be a big mistake politically, but also economically, to be taken down that particular rabbit hole. But the lesson of history, the lesson of modern history, are that the small advanced economies who are good and high performing economically have the most equal societies with a bigger role for government, less inequality, are those that get their governance right, that are respected, that when people lend them money, they know they're going to get it back. Now, I know that big countries can just misbehave. That's the history that Stephanie's referring to with the Fed. And it's happening in America now. Donald Trump's bullied the Fed into saying we don't care about inflation. Warren Buffett's very happy because that means you don't need to worry about the debt because inflation will eat into that. And so the stock market is boosted. And again, hedge fund billionaires that like this idea like that thought. I think if we spend too much time distracted by it, it's a big mistake. The reason we've got to the solution we've got to is because we are taking Scotland to a position of integration, to one of re-emerging, setting up our own central bank, putting good people in charge of it, being a good counterparty so we can borrow. I think on the deficit side, and it is worth saying, you know, we set out a very, and it was many people criticised it. We were saying how you would get the deficit within the stability pact rules in an orderly fashion to allow you to fund your deficit. The real test for me at the moment is less that than are people willing to lend to you at a rate that's not, too, the interest isn't too high. I think the lesson of current history, or sorry, the lesson of the markets just now, is that we will be able to borrow very cheaply. So it's not a priority for me in the aftermath of a crisis to be doing that. The priority for me now is to invest in a different future. And I think that's of interest. But there does come a point where we need to ensure that we're not putting too much of a burden onto the next generation. You know, if we're borrowing at an extortionate rate of interest, that's going to mean that we've got less to spend on the health service, on social security, and all of the things that we know that we need to spend on. So there's order to this, John. It's economics, but it's also politics. If you try this out the way that is being suggested, there's also, by the way, incidentally, a dishonesty in the argument. I've seen people arguing that Scotland would be unable to borrow because the Growth Commission says there would be no central bank. Well, the Growth Commission's recommendation is to create a central bank quickly. Yeah. So that's not true. And secondly, the central bank doesn't borrow. In the UK, it's the Debt Management Office, which is an agency of Treasury. Cambridge University can borrow. Aberdeen City Council can borrow. Of course, we would be able to borrow. The issue is how much interest do you pay in it? Exactly. And can you pay it back? And that's really important. We need to be seen in the world as a country with whom you can do business. You trust the rule of law. They're not going to, you know, create laws that mean that you've just lost value overnight, whether you're a lender or anyone else, that you can believe in Scotland. And I think the history of Scotland shows, you know, we would be very good at this. Yeah. And to your point earlier, we are starting on the journey. You know, I can't remember the number of 150 countries have joined the UN since the war when it was first created. At this point, we are more sophisticated. We're wealthier than any of the countries that have declared their independence in that period. We've got more money. We've got the institutions. We've got our own rule of law. We always have. We've got our own government. We've got our own civil service. The transition will not be simple. We can see from Brexit how not to do it. The transition, however, will be orderly and we can do it. And that's the way we've got to take this argument to people, not promising them that everything's for free because we've got a printing press and that life will get better. I find that as somebody who grew up in Lanarkshire, I find the false promises unforgivable. I find the idea that we gamble with my kids' future just to make a political point that's not been proven, I find that unacceptable. So I know it sounds beguiling and easy, but you know, I don't think it's the right thing to do at all, John.
Okay, good. Well, fair point. I'm not sure I entirely agree. I think there's some scope there, perhaps. But moving on to the business community for a second, because you're a successful businessman. Without naming names, what do you think the feeling is within the business community about independence? Has it changed?
In a surprising way. Yeah, I mean, there are loads of people implacably opposed. There's loads of people I speak to who just say, well, it just can't work. What about the deficit? You know, how's this going to work? But I've noticed very much over recent weeks, even in months, more and more people contemplating the reality of its possible inevitability. Yeah. Business people on the whole are the same, you know, they're the same as the people of Scotland. And with 55% already in favour, if you're speaking to somebody who's under 55 or under 35 and in business, you know, the chances that they are a pro-independence supporter are very high. Yeah. Business, obviously, many of them worry about, you know, you often hear people say, well, we just want stability. Yeah. There is no stability in the status quo with Brexit and with the governance that we've got at the moment. The bigger risk is being part of a country that's falling off an economic performance cliff. Yeah. So I'm not saying that the business community will be completely convinced, but I didn't detect that they were that opposed in 14. There was a lot of political topspin. The best way to contend with their position is to have a clear plan against which they can plan. Mm. We need to be honest about it. What's it going to look like? How's it going to work?
Yeah.
And, you know, business people employ lots of people, but the most people are employed by small businesses, by people who who, and I think the biggest thing we can do is respect that. People who bear risk, who knock their pans in, who put their lives on the line to create employment for others. Yeah. That's a thing. And Scotland has been brilliant at that for many, many years. And we need to be respectful of it, I would suggest. And the profit motive is a good thing, not a bad thing. Of course, when businesses pursue profit at the expense of the planet or by treating their workers badly, that's appalling. So this is back to your point in the Constitution and values we would seek, John. But we can do it differently. I'm not going to say that we can go off and convince all of the institutions that independence is a good thing. But I do think that the prospectus that we've got, the argument that is building, will mean that people are much more respectful of it. And in European capitals, you can already see people preparing, and if not openly supporting, then quietly supporting it.
Well, I see more and more feedback from European capitals where people are actually stepping up to the plate and saying, yes, I do. I suspect that's partly driven by the fact that the UK is about to leave, and therefore people feel freer to say what they've been thinking. But that's the way these things tend to work. A quick question, because we're almost through, and it's been great listening to you. It's actually been fantastic. And I do hope people have enjoyed it as much as I have. We've got 7 minutes to go. How do you respond to the question that you may be somewhat compromised here? Because the way people have put it on Twitter is, here you are, a lobbyist, but you're also working with the Scottish government. How does that work? How can you run with the hounds and chase with the hares, or whatever the expression is?
Well, again, this is a good example of what we've been talking about, the nature of Scotland, how we like to take people down and put a badge on them, then attack the badge. And so my short answer to the question is, I'm not a lobbyist. I don't go and speak to politicians on behalf of clients. Our business gives advice to companies about all of the risks they face in the markets, raising money in London, in particular in the stock market. We give advice on how to work with your employees to get the best from people, to engage them. And we do give advice on what is the regulatory and political landscape and how do you navigate it. But if we were ever to speak to a government official or minister on behalf of a client, it would show up in a register and people could see it. Yeah. And there's one example of me, which I think was going to see David Mundell in London. And that's hardly because he and I agree on anything. I think there's a couple of examples of Kevin Pringle, my dear friend and colleague, doing it on behalf of the Remain campaign for Europe. So it's not really what we do for a living at all. And another point is, I don't work for the Scottish government. The government doesn't pay me. This was a commission which the SNP commissioned. I didn't get paid for it, obviously. Did it because I love the cause, I love the party, and we were trusted to do it. But it's convenient to say, let's badge him, make him a bad person, because that stops us having to think. Yeah. On one hand, I could be offended by it, but you let these things wash over you, because I've been in the SNP for 37 years. Those that know me know where I'm coming from and what my commitments are. I think if you have to badge someone and attack someone in order to win an argument, you might be losing the argument.
Yeah.
And so I think it's completely overblown, that one, and not true. It's actually, it's not true. And I've said that before.
Yeah. Here's a question that never occurred to me. It's coming on Facebook. The question is, as and when you step back from a business career, would you consider going back into politics?
Well, one of the things about doing the Growth Commission to be freed up to do it is that I'm not courting political popularity. So the difficult honesties that I've had to try and put, and all the flack that I've taken from our own side, and of course the unionists hate the Growth Commission because they realise that there's a winning argument in there. And I think politics needs people to be able to do that. I think it's important. I beat myself up, John, every other day. I won't name names, but I'd said to a party colleague about something, I was moaning about something that the Scottish government had done. Yes, because I can criticise as well as support. And they basically said, well, my answer to that is that I'm going to put my life on the line and run. What are you going to do? And that gave me a real crisis of conscience, thinking, maybe I ought to. But the honest truth is, for me, right now at this point in my life, and it's not anything to do with business or anything like that, it's just looking after the three children that I've got. I find that knowing what politicians put in of all sides, the sort of 24/7 job, the weekends are all gone. If you're doing it properly, you're up really early or to bed really late. Yeah. I personally would find it quite difficult to reconcile that with my responsibilities at the moment. Yeah. I'm coming on 50, don't tell anyone. At the end of the year, would I seek to? I will basically do whatever I can, with on a voluntary basis to help the cause. And would I see myself doing it in the future? Well, you know, never say never. Say never. All I would say is I completely admire those that have knocked their pans in for the party. And those that are retiring, like Mike Russell and Rosanna Cunningham and many others like them, you know, who I grew up with almost. You know, Mike employed me to be the party's economist when I was 23, 24, something like that. And my job then was to say that GERS was rubbish. I was basically employed to say that GERS was rubbish. Nothing changes. And I look at these people and I just have so much admiration for them. But it's a privilege for me to be able to contribute whilst not being a, you know, a frontline politician. I mean, maybe. I mean, I don't know whether the party would have me.
I think they would have you in a shot. Quick question about GERS then. What confuses a lot of people about GERS is that the Scottish Government publishes GERS, and yet almost everyone, his brother and sister, says it's garbage. And I suspect you would probably say the same.
Well, it's not garbage. It just is not that helpful. I mean, if you look at what we put in the Growth Commission, I have this discussion with people all the time. The key fact, even assuming, because there's lots in GERS that's assumptions, but it's not bad assumptions. It's not. But if you think about it this way, Scotland right now raises as much in revenue as it needs to pay for all of the Scottish Government's budget, all of Social Security and all of pensions. We balance, broadly speaking, we balance that. So the deficit is not money coming over the border. The sort of GERS thing is not money coming over the border. That's spending on defence, foreign affairs, debt interest, crucially, many other international aid, many other programmes, many of which we would replicate, but many of which we wouldn't.
Yeah.
And it comes down to choice. Now, if you wouldn't start from here, by all means. But it's not really a question of where you're starting from. It's a question of where you want to get to.
I think what's missing is that qualifier that you just covered. I think that's what's missing for people. I think if that qualifier were there when the GERS report is issued, it would help a lot of people.
Yeah, but I
get very confused.
This year, for the first time, John, I think GERS backfired. I think people, it's incongruous for people. It also offends quite a lot of the middle ground that want, you know, that are open to be persuaded that aren't yet with us. The idea that we're somehow...
Sorry to interrupt. We've almost reached the end of our time.
Oh, sorry.
I told you it would go quickly. And it has. Okay. Thank you very much, Andrew. It's been great. I hope everyone, I'm sure they have appreciated it as much as I have. Thank you very much for giving up a whole chunk of your valuable time tonight. It's a big thank you to you. And a big thank you to all of you out there who've been watching the show. And very importantly, please support Indie Live. The folks who behind Indie Live do it mostly out of the love of the goodness of their hearts and the love for the cause. And it's great if you can support them or at least write in and say, hey, we like what you're doing, etc. And thanks again for joining us this evening. And remember, it's been a great day for British democracy. And just a little footnote from history. We talked about history earlier. On this day in 1745, the Scottish Army under Bonnie Prince Charlie marched into Edinburgh, took it without a shot, without a fight. You see how things change? Thank you, everyone. And thank you for joining us tonight. A big thank you to Andrew. Good night, everyone.
My pleasure.